Hello, welcome to the Unlocking Landscapes podcast. My name is Daniel Greenwood. So this is a special episode for me. It was the first one I've ever recorded overseas in Republic of Ireland, a place where my grandfather comes from, and it was recorded in County Mayo at a place called Enniscoe House and the woods surrounding Enniscoe House. And it was with the writer and poet Sean Lycett. So I've been interested in Sean's poems for probably about 10, 12 years or something like that, since my mum got a copy of his poems for me. And he's someone who really helped me to understand the nature, landscape and history of Mayo, and particularly that corner of Western Ireland. And so it was a huge privilege for me to be able to speak to Sean. And you know, Sean was really great in agreeing to come and meet me. He never met me before, didn't know I was, to record with him around the woods of Enniscoe House and just to the edge of Loch Conn, which is a huge water body, stunning area in County Mayo, really worth visiting if you're in the area. So Sean has published a number of books of poetry. His most recent publication came in 2022, which is New Leaf. I really love his poems, and I'd really recommend checking them out. He's also written a landscape nature writing book, which is about Wild Nathan National Park. Would really recommend checking that out too. It's just come into paperback. It was out of print in hardback. And I'm very lucky at the end of this recording that Sean actually read one of his poems. And I should probably say now that it ends in an unintended way. We were at the shore of Loch Conn, hiding under this porch that was just the edge of the water, and the rain, you could see it coming in, and it basically makes the recording of the second poem impossible. So Sean reads his first poem, which you can imagine is wonderful, and then just, you can hear the end of the recording, the rain just begins to sweep in and completely takes over the sound and the recording. But it makes for a really wonderful end to the recording, and Sean was really good about it too, so thank you for that, Sean. And I also wanted to say thank you so much to Sean for your patience, because we recorded this in September 2022. It's now October 2023. I've had a few IT issues with my software editing, and also work and stuff like that, but it's also, in all honesty, one that I did not want to get wrong. So though I don't edit things like a Hollywood movie or some of these other major podcasts you probably get, there is a lot of thought goes into it. And I, you know, when it's online, it's out there and you can't really take it back. So I wanted to make sure it was good and also that Sean was happy with it. But I think it's worth the wait. We cover a lot of ground. We talk about woodlands, invasive species. We talk about issues of nature conservation in Ireland. We talk about the history of a lot of the plants and the cultural heritage of plants. And it's a really immersive recording, and it's really lovely to listen to, I think, mainly because of the nature, not because of me talking. But yeah, I'll leave that there. But I just wanted to say thanks again to Sean for your patience and for meeting up with me. And I hope you enjoy the episode. Okay, thanks for listening.
Get down to the end of the wall. Then we've been to the garden, and I think into the wood, and you'll have a sense of why I like this place. They've heard woodpecker here, for instance, and the great spotted woodpecker is just spreading in Ireland now. It's pretty well established in the southeast,
but
it's spreading, and it hasn't quite come to Mayo yet. But there have been a couple of stray records.
Because it's not a species that's actually naturally found in Ireland, is it? A great spotted woodpecker.
Well,
or is it?
I suppose 20 years ago it was scarcely known in Ireland. But they did become established in the southeast, in places like Kilkenny and Carlow and Wicklow. And they're quite a familiar bird now to a lot of people in their gardens.
Wow, okay.
They have been spreading, and they're spreading through the Midlands, North Midlands, and places like Roscommon, Sligo, and there have been a few records in Mayo. So, and there's just lots of habitat and no competition.
Of course, yeah.
Well, you know, No tawny owls, no nuthatches, green woodpeckers.
They're very, very common in England.
Mm.
And they're increasing a lot more because of, well, it seems to be because of starlings declining.
Is that right?
Because starlings used to frequent nest holes in woodlands, but because they've declined so much, the woodpeckers have moved in.
That's excellent. They really do add something to a woodland.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Would you like to give a little introduction to about yourself and what you do, Sean? How do I pronounce your surname?
Sean Lycett.
Lycett. Okay.
Lycett.
Lycett.
My namesake, Joe Lycett. He's well known on BBC.
Yeah, my mum's a big fan.
Yeah. So, my name is Sean Lycett. I've lived in Westport, Mayo for almost 30 years now. And I write poetry and also write prose about wildlife and the landscape. I have a particular interest in County Mayo, in the wild parts of North Mayo, and I enjoy walking, exploring, fishing sometimes, and just generally being out and about in the natural world.
Oh, look, we've got some elm here.
Spotted.
Witch elm. So it's got that long tongue on it. It's really furry, but the leaves are quite big, and it's got, you can hear it, can't you? If you really hear it. Because this is one that seems to grow naturally in England. And it grows in ditches and hedgerows and stuff. But in South London, in some of the ancient woodlands in South London, you actually get some bigger ones. Because I think Oliver Rackham, the woodland historian, said that this was the only native elm in Britain.
Which elm?
Yeah. Mm. You can have a lot of fun with the name as well.
Right. I remember at the end of my book, Eagle Country, I remember coming up here and walking through the woods and just on that particular occasion watching the seeds of the elm falling off a tree just as we came back to the house here. It was a lovely occasion. I remember beautiful elms along the road on both sides of Adair in County Limerick, where I'm from. And of course, they were all felled in the 70s because of the elm disease. But you do occasionally see bits of it. Rarely the big tree, rarely a full mature elm, although there is one in the grounds of Newport House on Clew Bay, which I'm very, very fond of.
I've been to Clew Bay, yeah. So what can you tell us about the place that we're walking through at the moment? It's really green, woodland, lots of ivy. What have we got? Some beech trees around us. Where exactly are we then?
So we're in the grounds of Enniscoe House on the shores of Loch Conn, and this is a, probably you'd call it a semi-natural woodland, because there are a lot of influences here of planting. We were just looking at limes and beeches there in the car park. Lots of big beeches in here. That's a kind of characteristic tree of the planter in this country. But there's a good mixture as well of other broadleaves like alder, willow, birch. And it's, as a domain woodland, it's been relatively untouched really for a long, long time. So there's an excellent layering through the different stages of canopy. And as you say, there's a lot of ivy. And Colin Stafford Johnson, in his new wild garden in County Wicklow, reckons that ivy is the single most important plant in a woodland.
Really? So it's, why does he say that?
Well, because of the amount of cover it provides. It provides a lot of structure in the lower parts of the of the wood as well, where maybe the light isn't, there isn't so much light, but there's always ivy. And of course, ivy at this time of year now, its flower provides a late source of nectar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we have a lot of it in South London, in the woodlands there, and it really does divide opinion. And you have people coming in and actually into the woodlands, into the nature reserves, actually cutting it. Mm. Because somehow this idea has taken hold that ivy kills trees, when what I've learned is actually it just grows up a lot of number of trees that are in decline anyway. Mm-hmm. And then you find it actually standing on a dead tree. Yeah, so yeah, frame, sort of like been framed.
Well, there's really magnificent growth of ivy here.
Yeah.
And given the age and scale of these trees, I mean, the ivy just provides fantastic structure going up. Now there's a fantastic old beech. Oh, it looks like a good year for beech mast as well.
So you said that the beech tree in this part of Ireland is a sign of planting.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really one of the characteristic planter trees. It's widely planted in domains.
What are domains?
A domain really is the area of parkland around a big estate, and it's characterised by a lot of usually well spaced out trees, but there were also areas of protected woodland. And it's an important legacy from the big house in this country, because when the large estates were broken up around the turn of the century and during the foundation of the Free State, the larger tracts of land were parcelled off, but the land around the big house was often preserved intact. And nowadays, as here at Enniscoe, we have an example of a domain woodland, which is now an amenity for the public. And that's a pattern that's repeated in many places in Ireland. It's an important aspect of the legacy of the big house.
And I suppose that's similar to in England and Scotland and Wales, National Trust opening up all these big properties to the public to enjoy, if you remember.
Yes.
Usually.
Yes.
Yeah.
The history of big estates in Ireland is different from England and Scotland, because as we know, famously, so many of the big estates are still in private hands in Britain, whereas in Ireland, there was a completely different political regime once the Irish Free State was established, and that involved breaking up the big estates. Mind you, it's a process that had started before independence. It was already underway in the late 1800s, but then the Irish Free State completed the process, so you just don't have those huge private estates in this country any longer.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because where I live in Sussex, there's tons, like huge tracts of land. So I think the South Downs National Park, which spreads from Winchester to Eastbourne, I've seen maps that show, I don't know, 8 landowners owning, you know, 70% of the whole thing. Maybe that might be wrong, but landowners owning huge tracts of land, but it's not the case here then in Ireland.
Not at all, because I suppose you would go back to the 19th century and you would look at the abuses of landlordism in this country, where people were very badly treated in many, many instances. Not all, but in many instances. So there was a huge political push to allow farmers to acquire their land. And then with independence, that process was completed, so the estates were broken up. So it's the case anyway that there are very few large tracts of land like that in private ownership. Irish farms are, by British standards, quite small, especially the west of Ireland farms are quite small. So it's particularly important to have areas like Enniscoe here, where you have woodland preserved intact, managed by the house and also by the Irish Parks and Wildlife Service. So here where we are at the moment now, you can just see a lot of ivy growing up there on ash. And of course you'll see that this ash is already succumbing to the dieback disease. Mind you, it's a process that's been going for several years. I'm sure it'll take a long time. And we are also being told that there are some trees that seem to resist the ash disease. So that is presumably going to allow the species to continue. But the fact remains that the greater number of our ash trees are dying now, quite sadly.
Yeah, that, and I think in Sweden they found that some are surviving. So hopefully it will be the case that some of them can come through it.
What I love as well is the number of things here. This is quite wet. We're quite close to the lake. So there's a...
To Loch Conn?
Yes, quite close to Loch Conn here.
There's actually been a bit of rain falling, and I somehow... Oh, here we go. Managed to forget my coat, but it's fine. I can just see that there's an oak tree growing here, and that doesn't seem to be something that you find that often in Mayo.
Well, in a lot of the woodland in Mayo, you have grazing animals. You have sheep, cattle, in some cases deer. Well, it's lovely to see a rich ground layer here and examples of natural regeneration. I mean, there are a lot of woodlands in Mayo, in Ireland generally, where the impact of grazing is quite severe. And because of sheep, cattle, deer, there really is little regeneration naturally. But this woodland now is wonderful because there is a good level of natural regeneration, and I don't see signs of encroachment by grazing animals. So it's another aspect of this place that's particularly wonderful to my mind.
And the woodland is different here, isn't it? Because it's a different type of woodland. I think the oak woodland is called Atlantic oak woodland, or some people call it Celtic rainforest. So it looks a lot like rainforest, doesn't it? It's very mossy, and a lot of the trees, the growth is quite stunted. You don't get these same sort of, you know, high canopy oak woodlands that you might get in parts of England and Europe and stuff like that.
I suppose using the word rainforest for our oak woodland is debatable, really. It obviously conjures up the Amazon or the Congo Basin and things like that. I think it's just a way of labelling our woodland to draw people's attention to the incredible biodiversity that is there. And certainly if you go to, let's say, an oak woodland like the woodland outside Glengariff in Cork, there you have an extraordinary riches of bryophytes and ground flora and so on. I suppose there are probably scientific categories around rainforest and what exactly constitutes rainforest, but I'm willing to go with it, especially in a place like this. Now it does seem correct, doesn't it? Because we're close to the lake, we're close to the water table. It is very wet. There's a very rich ground layer. You've got a rich growth of moss, and right through the different stages, then right up to the top, to the canopy, you have good vegetation structure.
It's also raining.
And it's raining.
Because in the south of England, it didn't rain for, I don't know, for like 2-3 months or something. So it's very refreshing to be here in this. And that's Tutsun. Do you know Tutsun?
Yes, that's lovely now, isn't it? It's fruiting at this time of year.
So that's a Hypericum, isn't it? That's the scientific name. So it's like St. John's wort relative, I think. But yeah, you get that in woodlands in England as well, ancient woodlands.
And I was here earlier this year, and it was delightful to hear all of the warblers that were singing or holding territory here. You had lots of blackcap, lots of chiffchaff, and lots of willow warbler. I particularly like chiffchaff because it I associate it very much with a kind of high canopy woodland, and I also have kind of personal memory of chiffchaff because the little cottage where we used to spend summers as a family in County Kerry, there would always be a chiffchaff on a large hawthorn just outside the gate. So I love to hear the chiffchaff, and it's the willow warbler is probably the more typical Philoscopus warbler of the west of Ireland. It's very common, abundant.
Yeah.
It's just about over now. The chiffchaff then is less common, but you will hear several here in the woods in the summer.
And it's also very quiet now, isn't it? Because the birds must be exhausted after breeding season.
Yes, it's a time of the year when they're moving, when they're on the move. The swallows have gathered and they're going, if not gone.
Yeah, they're where me and my mum are at the moment. They're all getting together and feeding up, and
you see the groups there.
Yeah.
on the cables. Actually, another sign of the time of year, as I was coming up here, just driving along Loch Beltra, I saw an osprey.
Oh, wow.
Which is the kind of bird you would expect to see on migration in a place like Beltra. I have seen one ever before on Loch Conn, just next to us here, but I was delighted this morning to see an osprey clearly migrating, moving through on its way south. We don't yet have ospreys in Ireland that I'm aware of. There might be one or two breeding that we don't know of for obvious reasons. But we think that ospreys might be about to recolonise Ireland.
Wow.
So that was a lovely thing to see this morning.
Yeah,
on
jealous,
our way up here.
Yeah. I don't know how many I've seen. I think I've seen one in Somerset.
Mm.
No, that was a bittern. I think we'd hoped to see them, but... But yeah, wow, that's a nice thing
very
to see
nice
today.
Nice thing
yeah.
to see, yeah.
Maybe something not so nice to see, which we've stopped next to, is, and it also gets into your poems, rhododendron.
Yes.
Growing in a sort of, well, it's sort of becoming a clearing because the ash trees are sort of dying back.
Yes.
But what's the significance of rhododendron in the landscapes that you know in Ireland?
Well, it's a big problem, basically. As we know, it was planted on the big estates to provide ground cover for game in the 19th century, and it has spread. It's very much at home in this climate, in this landscape. There have been attempts in a number of places to deal with rhododendron, most notably in Killarney.
That's in Kerry, isn't it?
In Kerry,
yeah.
Yes. And that has been only a very partial success. There are large parts of the Killarney National Park that have still got serious rhododendron infestation, and it is apparent that rhododendron is choking some of the oak woodlands. We have a major problem with rhododendron in Mayo. There are large tracts of rhododendron, and of course rhododendron gets into the management reports about what should be done with it and how much money might be needed to deal with rhododendron. But I think even the most optimistic management documents now talk about control rather than eradication, because it's so well established, and the the money and manpower that would be required to eradicate it just is not forthcoming. It's not going to happen. So I'm afraid it's a plant we have to live with. We don't like to see it taking over and choking everything. But it's a plant that you can live with as, you know, a component of a ground layer in a woodland, as long as it's not allowed to monopolize.
Didn't they talk about getting the army in to deal with it? Was there something, someone in the Irish Parliament was talking about getting the army in to deal with it or something?
Well, you'll get these political gestures now and again, but whether it's the army or the private citizenry, really, it's just on a scale that I don't think it is going to be eradicated. I think all we can talk about is control.
Big raindrop just fell right on the microphone and knocked all the sound out. It's kind of the same in the UK with a lot of the, in England with a lot of the species, you know, things like cherry laurel, which is just, you know, I would say just as invasive as rhododendron, really, particularly in woodlands. Having spent a lot of time in my own work removing it, but there's so many species that won't ever go away. Like everyone goes on about turkey oak as well, which is supposed to hybridize with the native oaks, but apparently that's not necessarily true. But even if you were like removing turkey oaks, is almost pointless because they've just completely spread beyond, you know, that there's never going to be enough funding or workforce to ever deal with these things. It has to become manageable, doesn't it, really? So
yeah, I think you have to be realistic. And there are landscapes now, you know, where rhododendron is a component of the scrub layer in woodland, and it provides cover for woodcock, for instance, in winter. And that's not just about hunting, that's just a fact that it provides that cover for these birds. So I think we just have to accept that it is here to stay. And there are some interesting habitats as well in the planted, in the coniferous plantations in the parts of Mayo that I'm familiar with, where because the ground is so poor, the lodgepole pine and sitka didn't really grow properly to create a proper canopy. So what you get is a kind of a scrub, effectively a scrub of stunted conifers, plus rhododendron, plus a lot of other bogland plants. So it's kind of a bog scrub, bog scrub, which is not something that science really has been very interested in up to now, because it's a new category. But there is a lot of that in the parts I'm familiar with, and it is a habitat with an interest of its own.
Cool. I think it'd be good to talk about some of your books. I've been reading your poems since 2013, I think. Well, I think maybe my mum might have got one of your poetry books for me, and I've bought some since, and I really like them. So it's really nice to be able to speak to you today. So you've recently published a book of poems called New Leaf, which we can get onto. But I did want to talk to you about Wild Nathan, which is a book that came out in 2020. Okay. Yeah. And I really enjoyed it. It's the sort of book I've been looking for this to learn more about the landscape of Mayo and Ireland in general. But could you tell us a bit more about Wild Nathan?
Okay, well, Wild Nathan, I suppose, really is a follow-on from the previous book, Eagle Country. Eagle Country was a series of summer excursions to see eagles, or to see places where eagles used to breed in Mayo and in other parts of the West. So it was about the summer. So then I wanted to focus a bit more on the part of Mayo that I knew best, which was the Nathan Begg mountain range, principally. And I wondered, having written a book about the summer, could I do something about winter? So Wild Nathan was conceived originally as a series of winter excursions to see, you know, what the landscape would be like, what interest you could discover in the wild landscape across the winter months. And I suppose there was a little seasoning there from Michael Viney, who once said that winter was his favourite season. And by that, I think perhaps he said it a little bit pointedly, meaning that during the winter you don't have tourists, you have or very few tourists. So there's a sense that you've got the place to yourself again. So you're you're free, I suppose, to discover the place without, you know, the certain distraction of visitors. So I went back and I drew on my knowledge of places in Mayo that I had gone, had walked as an angler or just a rambler. And then there were other places that I was less familiar with, so I felt the need to walk, explore, find out more about the landscape. And that's pretty much it. That's how the thing happened. The actual production of the book then was focused, I suppose, by the pandemic, and I decided to publish it under my own imprint, whereas Eagle Country had been published by Little Taller Books in Dorset.
Oh yeah, I know that.
My wife and I published it under our own imprint. We see ourselves, if you like, as craft publishers. And being under lockdown at home, it did allow us that kind of focus, that intensity. And I don't think it would have happened otherwise had it not been for the lockdown at the time of COVID.
I was completely ignorant to that. I did not realise at all that you published it yourself. Because I actually went into the independent bookshop in Ballinar, which I've completely forgotten the name of right now, but I'll put it in the description for the podcast and a link to the website and stuff. I had a really nice chat to the man who owns it, and again, I didn't get his name, but
Raymond.
There you go. Ray. Yeah, he was really nice, and he said it was you couldn't buy it anymore. I went to buy it for my uncle, so will it be making a comeback? Do you think?
You might be able to get one here, because I've just had a conversation, and they couldn't tell me. They weren't sure if they had any copies left, but if you ask, you might get it here on the way back.
Right,
it might be a way of just giving them a little nudge.
And quite coincidentally, we've just left the woodlands and we're now at the water's edge, vast area of water, which I'm guessing is Loch Conn.
That's right.
And under a cloud, right in front of us, is the gigantic shape of Nathan.
That's right. So you've Nathan Moor, or Big Nathan, let's call it. That's a fine, it appears like a pyramid from several angles, although
it's
really more like a kind of armadillo. And then farther west you have the Nathan Beg mountain range, which is named after Small Nathan, which is a mountain within the range. But Nathan Moor, Big Nathan there, is a really fine mountain. It's just about 800 meters, not a huge summit by any means, but a very imposing one, because it's sort of on its own, separate from the rest.
And we're quite lucky because we've actually got some shelter we can quickly just go to, and I don't think there's anyone there. It seems to be like a fishing or a boat hire shelter. Ah, that's lucky, isn't it? Yeah, so it's fantastic views across the water. And are those the Ox Mountains in the distance over there? That way?
They are, yes.
So that's where I've come from this morning, just at the foot of the Ox Mountains.
So you had to drive all the way around Loch Conn?
Yeah, through Ballinar and over here.
Loch Conn is a fine fishing lake as well, incidentally.
So we're just on the shore of Loch Conn here, and there's loads of interesting plants that we're just going to talk a little bit about. So what have we got here, Sean?
We've got
scrubby thing.
We've got a lot of alder freely seeding, and then we've got a mixture of we've got scabious.
Devil's bit
scabious, I believe. And we have a lot of grass of Parnassus, which is a beautiful, really particularly beautiful plant. And bog myrtle as well.
It's supposed to be quite fragrant.
Yes, if you crush,
If
you crush the leaf, you'll get something that reminds you of some bath soap bath.
You do see that, actually.
Bath oil.
You do see it advertised.
Yeah.
I'm not getting much smell on.
Just crush the little bud.
The bud, okay.
Yeah, it's quite intense if you crush it there.
Oh, yeah.
It's a nice thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
There is a tradition in Mayo that bog myrtle was originally a much bigger plant. It was a big, broad, spreading tree. This is in the folklore. And that the wood of the tree was used in the crucifixion. So as a kind of punishment, God decided to reduce bog myrtle to just a small shrub.
It's just below waist height, isn't it, for us?
Yes.
Here. Probably lower than that, really.
It's a lovely little aromatic shrub out on the bog.
Apologies to the listener who can't smell this right now, and it's not a very common plant.
It is, actually.
Is it here?
It's a very widespread bog plant, yes.
In bogs it is?
Yes.
Yeah. Because I think that's the thing I suppose I'm talking from my English perspective of there not being many bogs in England.
Yeah, there's plenty of bog myrtle around here. Yeah. And we have a bit of tufted vetch.
Tufted vetch, right.
Out of flower now.
That's in the pea family, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Trailing around the bog myrtle. And it's very much scabious time, isn't it?
Yeah, this lovely deep purple sort of colour. Mm. Got some self-heal there. Mm. Still flowering.
Yes, a great flower. If you rewild your lawn and just stop cutting your lawn around here, you'll get masses of self-heal.
It's a good phrase to use there, because you said rewilding the lawn. Something, obviously, rewilding is hugely in fashion at the moment, a big topic for discussion. Well, what have you found there?
I think we've got some yellow rattle as well.
Ah.
I think we're told that that's an important plant. Again, yep. For the rewilded lawn, because it's a parasitic plant, and I think it keeps down the very lush growth, and it allows other plants to come through.
And it's called yellow rattle because the seeds are supposed to rattle, aren't they, in the casings, apparently.
Yes, that's the theory.
Yeah. It's a plant that's really popular in... Did you hear any rattling?
No,
there?
I didn't get the rattle. Just
maybe
then.
The seeds have gone. It's very popular in British conservation of grasslands like chalk and limestone grass and stuff, because it, as you say, it does shut down those more coarse grasses.
The grass of Parnassus is a particularly beautiful plant, isn't it?
It is.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Five-petal flower. And quite a lot of it's still on the way, actually.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Right beside us here, we've got three flowers and we've got two just in bud, still two.
And it's what? It's the 7th of September today?
Still quite a bit to see, isn't there?
Yeah.
In the flowering season.
And so we can actually see more of Nathan. It's appearing from under that cloud again. But in your book, you're writing a lot about the projects and the ongoing work to rewild the landscape around Nathan.
Yes.
And that's a lot of commercial plantation, isn't it? And
yeah.
Which is, you know, one species or two species. Yeah. And how is that going? I mean, what are the prospects for wildlife in the Nathan range?
Well, I think the prospects are very good. We have a lot of naturally quite wild landscape in this area anyway. And if you go to the Wild Nathan Wilderness Project itself, that's a very specific area where the national park, which is a national park, broadly speaking, of blanket bog, has also inherited several thousand hectares from the Forestry Service. And the Forestry Service basically have decided that it's no longer commercially viable. So they are now pulling out. As we speak, I think they have virtually finished their clear felling operations. So the National Parks and Wildlife Service have inherited a large area of commercial conifer plantation. Now, there are various stages, various kinds of woodland within that. Some of it is plantation that failed, lodgepole pine principally, and also Sitka spruce, some larch, which essentially has failed because it was established on very poor soil, very wet peat. And as I mentioned, that does provide habitat of its own, of a kind. Not something that people are perhaps very excited about, and yet it's there, this kind of bog scrub, as I call it. Then there are large tracts of lodgepole pine, particularly, and Sitka spruce, which are growing on pretty much as intended by the forestry people. And I think that's where some of the questions arise, you know, how much of that is going to be cleared? Is it going to be thinned? Or do you allow it just to grow on? Because you can also see in other areas where lodgepole pine has been allowed to grow on that some of it is flattened by wind, some of it rots back, and where the canopy breaks, then you get light in and you get rhododendron comes, heathers, sundews, and so on. So there's a whole process going on there, and I think as we speak they are still studying that landscape and trying to decide, you know, what are the most valuable components and which areas need to direct intervention and management.
I could just see the rain moving across the loch there.
I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment when we get in here to our, back to our shelter.
Thank goodness for this little shack.
Yes.
Some denim shorts on the ground.
Yes.
And a brush cutter that's quite rusted. So yeah, we're looking across the water now and we can see the rain coming in from the privilege of our shelter here.
Yeah.
It's still a stunning view. And again, having been in southern England where there's been 40 degree temperatures and no rain, it is so good to see rain falling.
Mind you, we've had quite a dry summer here as well. I mean, the rain has just started for the last few days, but you can see that the lake is quite low. There's quite a lot of exposed shoreline here, and you're getting a very good view of the Phragmites reeds because you can see right down to the base virtually. So we're very pleased to see rain as well.
And one question I did want to ask you was how people in Mayo view these kind of wilder landscapes. It's quite a broad question, I know.
It is a very broad question, and I was trying to put a point to it, and I think that there are several aspects to the dynamic. I think culturally and educationally people are much more aware nowadays of the value of the living world, wildlife. There's an awful lot of information out there, a lot of good television, a lot of good education. But then there are other factors that work against that. Development, of course, is one. Another one would be the farming practices under the Common Agricultural Policy, which is happening on a much bigger scale, and it impacts on what's happening in Germany as well as in Ireland, and
yeah,
including the west of Ireland. So sometimes when you look at what's being done to comply with European farm subsidy schemes, you would wonder whether anyone has been watching David Attenborough, whether anyone has listened to all the lessons we've been getting about biodiversity and the need to protect our bogs and our wild landscapes. So I think it's part of a dynamic. Culturally, yes, we've made a lot of progress, and there have been, small, very fine projects, rewilding projects, land management projects. But in the engine room of the Common Agricultural Policy, you sometimes wonder whether anything really has changed.
In terms of bogs, they're obviously, peatlands have been a crucial part of local fuel and the development of, the human populations in Ireland for a very long time. And they're also surprisingly wild and ecologically rich landscapes, aren't they?
Yes, indeed, they are. And we're getting some very interesting, some startling data now about the amount of carbon that is actually stored in the Western peats. So there again, it's probably a similar thing culturally. We know, we understand much more about our bogs than we used to. I think there is generally an appreciation of bogs. It's no longer a label, you know, of some kind of an inferior peasantry.
But wastelands, then, as the English used to call them.
Yes, I mean, that used to be the thing here as well, up to 20 or 30 years ago, you might say. But obviously with the energy crisis now, there is some pressure again to cut turf, and even to exploit it on an industrial level. My own view is that I believe that people should be able to continue to harvest peat by hand using traditional methods, but I find the machines that are used now to cut turf are very destructive, and I don't like to see that.
Isn't that the case with so many things that people are really turning against now, though? Because, you know, there's a big movement, sort of the veganism movement, and people are trying to reduce the amount of meat they consume. But a lot of that is industrially produced, you know, food. That's the problem. It's the way that this stuff is produced is what's so damaging. The same with, you know, a lot of forestry, obviously, when done on an industrial scale with heavy machinery, and can be really, really damaging. So it's the way it's done rather than the actual thing itself. Because obviously, well, in England, there's a big movement, like all the wildlife trusts are moving together against peat. And I think, you know, peat extraction for use in compost and stuff like that. So it's a kind of consumer action. And I believe that's now going to be banned in the next few years. But it's going to be the peat that's being put into compost is not being done by local communities, is it? It's being done by the wide-scale industrial kind of exploitative industry.
That's as I understand it. And I wish I could get peat-free compost myself in this part of Ireland, but I'm afraid it's quite difficult to find. And I don't think there is much momentum yet behind the movement to ban peat-based compost in garden centres here.
And I must say, from visiting Ireland most years of my life, particularly as a child, I only knew I was in Ireland when I could smell, you know, the peat, I think the briquettes being burned or the peat being burned. And I know there's a lot said about smell, how it draws you back to certain experiences, but it absolutely puts me back in childhood. And I don't know if you smell it as much anymore.
I think if you go to West Mayo, you'll still smell peat.
Yeah.
And of course, now with the cost of oil and with our energy crisis, it is noticeable that there is more peat being cut and more being offered for sale again.
Because where I live in Sussex, there's a lot of wood burners that people use. And I always feel like, you know, when there's someone who has Irish heritage or who's Irish living there, because you can smell peat sometimes. My next door neighbour's from Limerick, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, so right. I don't know if he burns peat, but I think he does burn wood sometimes. But
well, I think there it's an example of the outsider finds this kind of romantic, but the people who actually have to cut it and dry it and store it and then burn it, they don't find anything romantic about peat. It's associated with hardship.
Yeah, indeed. But
we have a couple of herons there making their way across the lake.
The lake looks very sort of glassy now, even though the water's moving, but the sun's come out a little bit.
And of course, whenever I see a heron these days, I sort of look carefully because I'm hoping to see a sea eagle. We have reintroduced sea eagles in this country since 2007, and Loch Conn is one of these places where sea eagles turn up very occasionally as they wander about the island looking for territories. But no, that wasn't a sea eagle, that was certainly a heron.
Well, they're so big, aren't they, herons? You do see them, and there's part of your brain, if you are into sort of, you know, bird watching, you do think eagle.
Yes.
Well, I get that from pigeons sometimes. I think, oh, sparrowhawk. But anyway, Yeah, so my dad said that he'd seen an eagle over the Ox Mountains in the past sort of 15 years, but I've never seen anything over there. But they seem to be making a comeback, I think, in England, or in Sussex, actually. They've been reintroduced into the Isle of Wight, and they've made their way over. How do you know how they're getting on, the sea eagles?
In Ireland?
In Ireland.
They're doing quite well. They began the reintroduction program in 2007 and released birds mainly in the Killarney area, and the sort of the descendants or the birds from that release established territories in Kerry and West Cork, and also surprisingly along the Shannon system, particularly on Loch Derg between Clare and Tipperary. And there are birds now that have been established on territories in those areas for getting on for 15 years. And a couple of them are very productive territories, actually, particularly the Loch Derg and the Killarney ones. Now, having said that, it was recognised that the population needed a boost a few years ago. And with the great generosity of the Norwegian partners, they've been bringing over some more sea eagles and releasing them again at Killarney, also along the Shannon, and there's another site in West Waterford. So this is designed to kind of boost the population, as was done, incidentally, in Scotland as well, where the first phase of the sea eagle reintroduction on the island of Rum then was followed up some years later by a second phase reintroduction in, I believe, Wester Ross. So sea eagles are doing fairly well in Ireland at the moment. There have been a few setbacks. Obviously, there have been some widely publicised poisoning incidents. Mm. But I think against that, we have to say that there are a good many of these sea eagles have been secure and safe on their nesting territories since about 2010, and I think the future is looking bright for the species.
Great news! That's what we like to hear. And that, I mean, they should be here, shouldn't they? I mean, look at this place.
Yeah,
they'd be definitely at home here, and I'm sure they were here before they disappeared originally.
Yeah, I think it's well recognised as well that sea eagles is a species that can live quite close to people. Like, there is a territory down near Glengariff in Cork where there's quite a bit of boat traffic and quite a few visitors, the people going out to Garnish Island see these eagles regularly and are quite close to the nesting pair. So if the persecution is removed, then sea eagles will have no trouble. There's so much suitable habitat for them.
Thanks, Sean. I think to finish, you've got a new book of poetry out, and you've really kindly offered to read out some of the poems from the book. Would you be happy to do that?
I'd be delighted.
Fantastic. Nice
to be, Daniel. Thanks for the invitation. So as we've just come through the woodland, I'll read this poem from the new book, Green Man. When he came with his scholarly credentials, blustering on about an old motif on a water font, I told him to go. I said, enough of your drolleries, you old fool of self. I have my own ways here. I know where to park the car and set out along the L1810, where light shifts in the shadows. May has borrowed an April breeze to flaunt leaves of cow parsley. I found him just here, as heavy as a deer calf, lying down among the anemones. There was innocence in his eyes, like a baby out of sleep. It was touching how he put his arms around my shoulders as we rang for an ambulance for next of kin. Willow warbler still wavers down the ladder of summer on its song, my anthem. And one of these days I'll be up there in the ivy with a grin on me like a Cheshire cat. You can report me like this, breeze blown but happy, in a lift and settlement of leaves.
Wonderful, thank you.
I'll read another one, if I may.
Yes, please. Please do.
This is from a little set of sort of rough and ready sonnets. The sequence is called Bracha. It's a reference to a place near where I live. And this is about the river, and particularly that moment when there's been a lot of heavy rain, and especially after dry weather, you go to the river to see the effect of the flood. And it's curious that as I begin to read, we can actually hear the patter of the rain coming across the lake. It's not raining quite here just yet, but we can hear the rain approaching.